You can shop from anywhere doing pretty much anything. You might shop while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast. And however you shop, we all know and love the thrill of the hunt. But do you also know how to get the thrill of the best deals? Because Rakuten shoppers do. With Rakuten, they get the deals they love with the most savings and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Sephora, Nike, and even Expedia if you're looking to get some travel in. And getting cash back doesn't mean you have to miss out on sales because those can just be stacked right on top. It's easy to use and based on a simple idea. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back through PayPal or check. Download the free Rakuten app and never miss a deal. Or go to Rakuten.com to start getting the most bang for your buck. That's Rakuten.
Contained herein are the heresies of Radolf Buntwine, erstwhile monk turned traveling medical investigator. Join me as I uncover the blasphemous truth of a plague-ridden world, that ours is not a loving God, and we are not its favored children. The Heresies of Radolf Buntwine, coming January 2nd, wherever podcasts are available.
I'm Kim Strobel, and I'm the only one who suffered from debilitating panic attacks. And so now I honor my fierceness, but I love and accept my vulnerabilities because they are part of who I am on a daily basis. They deserve to be and take up space.
Imagine feeling like you were the only one in the room dealing with crippling fear. Podcaster, happiness, educational and empowerment coach, Kim Strobel, dealt with panic attacks as a teen and a young adult. She struggled to do simple things like drive to work or even walk to the mailbox. But what would you do if it got so bad that you pleaded with God to take your life and received a message that you were made for more? Would you dismiss it as a delusion and prepare to die? Or would you become the chief happiness officer of your life and show others how to overcome their fears? Hi, I'm Laura Cathcart Robbins, and this is The Only One in the Room. In September 2018, I found myself in an all too familiar position. Looking around the room at the other attendees at a famed writer's retreat, I realized that I was the only Black woman in the room. When I wrote about my experience for the Huffington Post, something surprising happened. 24 hours after my piece went live, I had 568 direct messages in my inbox. These were messages from people of all races, ethnicities, creeds, and nationalities who had connected with my piece because they too had felt othered. These are the stories we want to share. This podcast is for anyone who has ever felt alone in a room full of people, which is to say that this podcast is for everyone. You're listening to The Only One in the Room, presented by Lipstick and Vinyl, and executively produced by Christina Barcy. Make sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts, and be sure to like and leave us a review of your thoughts on the show. And if you have an Only One in the Room story you'd like to share, you can DM us on Instagram at The Only One in the Room. Enjoy the show. Kim Strobel, hello, from sunny Indiana. On a cold L.A. day.
I know. How many days do you get to call Indiana and they got better weather than L.A.?
Yeah, that's so wrong on so many levels.
I'm feeling much better about myself over here in Southern Indiana.
Yeah, yes. So you're Southern Indiana. Are you near Kentucky?
I am. I'm right on the river, so I'm 5 minutes from Kentucky. So right. My accent is even more Southern because of that.
Yes, yes. Well, Kim, I have a question for you. I want to know, what song always brings you out onto the dance floor?
Oh my goodness. That is so easy for me to answer.
Tell me.
Well, as a public speaker, I travel across and get on stages. And one of the things that we do is we always dance, and I get people up on the stage, and it's the troll song. I'm so bad at like actual title of songs, but it's the one in Trolls where they're all like, I have a whisper in my pocket, and it's all about like happiness and joy. I'm going to go to my Spotify list and find it.
I'm going to find it for you.
You're causing me anxiety right out of the gate because, listen, when I was a little girl, I had a friend who wanted to play a game all of the time because her dad had a huge record collection.
Yeah.
And I was really bad with songs and she wanted to play the game, like name this song. And I lost that game every time. And now right out of the gate, you're asking me
about a song. Oh, no.
Is it called Can't Stop the Feeling?
That's you.
Yeah, that's it. Oh, good. Good job, hon.
Thank you for saving
excellent.
Me.
Can't that Stop the Feeling. Can you sing a little bit of it, Kim?
Oh, Lordy. Just like that whole pocket thing. Yeah. I've got the dance moves.
Okay, you've got the dance moves. Okay. Okay.
Yeah, we're going to have a short video attached to this.
Yeah, a short video of Kim dancing to this. I'm sure we could find one online.
Yes, you could.
Because you come out to do your talks with it. That's great.
Yeah.
Thank you for that. Thank you, hun, for finding that song.
Absolutely, honey.
I am Laura Cathcart Robbins, and this is the only one in the room, but I am never the only one in this room because, as usual, my boyfriend, producer, and co-host, Scott Slaughter, who I call hun, is here as well.
Hi, honey.
Hey, honey. So today we have with us podcaster, happiness, educational, and empowerment coach, Kim Strobel. Yay.
Hi, Kim.
Happy to be here.
Yay. Kim spent her childhood, teen, and young adult years dealing with panic attacks and crippling fear. Kim has now taught thousands across the country how to reclaim their purpose, discover their potential, and achieve new levels of prosperity, which is so cool. So welcome, Kim.
Thank you. Thank you. I always say, you know, the happiness coach, that doesn't mean that I'm sunshine and sprinkles and a unicorn. There's a really big backstory to the whole birthing of the happiness coach. So
good. We want to hear it. And before we get into the interview, I just wanted to shout out Sarah Dean of the Shameless Mom Academy.
What up, Sarah Dean?
All roads lead to Sarah Dean.
She is fantastic.
She is fantastic. And she has connected us, or so many guests have connected with me because either they heard me on her show, or they saw me do the opening keynote for her this year, or, you know, it's just in the community of, you know, we shout each other out on social media.
Yeah, and she's just been a huge supporter of the show since
huge
we started.
Huge supporter, yeah. And Shameless Mom Academy podcast for anybody who's a mama, whatever that looks like, is an amazing podcast. So definitely check it out. So we're going to start kind of from the beginning. And I just want to also say quickly that, you know, we've had people talk about panic attacks in passing on the show before, but we've never really focused on what it's like to be the only one who feels like you're dealing with this. Mm. And it's so prevalent, you know, not just in the United States, but all over the world. And I feel like there's still a stigma around it. I feel like people don't talk about it enough. And so I was so, so happy to find you because you are destigmatizing it and you are talking about it and you tell your story with such candor. So I'm really glad to have you on. And I wanted to just have you start by talking about what it was like to be an anxious child. I know you talked about like walls closing in, feeling disconnected, catastrophizing. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. And you know what's interesting, Laura, is hearing you say that, you know, that isolation, that feeling of not thinking that anyone else has ever felt like you, and definitely feeling a great amount of shame and worry and concern about your mental health and ability. Like just hearing you say that statement, this doesn't always happen, but like that just ignited some emotion in me because just hearing you say that takes me back to how truly alone I felt. And so, yeah, I always tell people, and you'll be able to pick up on this pretty quickly in the podcast, but I'm a pretty like high energy woman. You know, I talk fast, I move fast. I always tell people I run 35 miles a week. I bike 20 miles a week. I meditate and it's still not enough to calm my butt down. So, you know, there's this like energy that comes with me. And when I was a little girl, I always had that energy, but it also like really manifested in very anxious ways. And so I think back to my childhood, I had two younger brothers and I remember I would run outside and if I could not locate my brothers immediately, my mind automatically thought that they had been kidnapped, that they were never returning. I would run back in the house and tell my mom, I can't find the boys. And, you know, she'd be like, Ken, they're probably out in the woods playing, or they're down at the neighbors. And then there's all these little moments like that. Like when I was in fifth grade, my parents surprised us and they were like, hey, we're going to take you to Disney World. And I was immediately scared. I told my mom, like, I don't want to go to Disney World. You know, what if my brothers get lost? What if something happens? And I remember even telling my mom, like, okay, the only way I'm going to go to Disney World is if I'm allowed to have like those dog leashes where the leash is attached to my wrist and the other end is attached to my two brothers.
Wow.
I mean, What fifth grader says that?
Yeah. I mean, that's.
My mom was like, we're getting you counseling. Right.
She wasn't getting you leashes.
Yeah. No, because like, you know, and the thing is like, I am functioning normally, right? I'm going to school, I play sports, I have friends, but for a child that young to be, I mean, extremely concerned about navigating this theme park with her family and keeping everybody safe. And so, you know, when I look through that, it seems like I would have incidents like that, and then maybe I would get better for a little while. But then when I was in middle school, I remember doing things like going down the hallway and saying, if I don't touch the wall in this spot, my dad is going to get killed in a car accident today.
Yeah.
Or I know my dad he's a house painter. And so he arrived home at 6 every night. So then like when I was in eighth grade, if the clock struck 6:01 and my dad wasn't home, I was in the bathroom throwing up, feeling nauseous, convinced that this terrible tragedy had happened. And so all of that, when I look back and reflect, I see that there was these catastrophizing thoughts that were constantly being flooded in my brain.
But what did you think about what was happening to you then? Did you think, obviously you knew you were different because you didn't see your brothers or your parents or your peers going through the same things, right? Worrying to the extent that you worried. What did you think was going on when you were nauseous or did you say nauseous?
Yeah. I think I just thought, I don't believe at that time that I was overly bothered by my behaviors because this felt like the right thing to be worried about. Like I didn't know it was wrong to be worried about these things. And other than kind of keeping safety checks on everyone, I still was able to go to a friend's house and spend the night or ride my bike through town. Like there were no physical limitations to what I could do at that time. It was just a heaviness in my mind and a responsibility that didn't make sense for my age.
Got it. Did you have a safe space? Did you have if you checked everything at home and like everybody, like for me, when my kids are in their bed at night for the night and not they're grown men, but even still,
it doesn't change anything.
I can relax. Like I know that I'm safe. Did you have something like that?
At that time, no. But when I eventually did have, and even to this day have a safety mechanism, but really the safety piece of that, like a place where I felt safe or associated safety, didn't really come until this illness became like the greatest monster in my life, which would have been my sophomore year of high school.
Okay, good. So tell us about that.
Well, I was kind of a quiet, shy young girl. And then when I got in high school and I was a really great athlete and I just really started to step into who I thought I was. And I felt confident. I felt good about who I was. I always, believe it or not, I always had this fierce independence inside of me. I wanted to go places and have experiences. And I had such faith in my independent ability to do so. But I was in my sophomore language arts class and I started having these episodes that would come about out of the blue within a half of a second. And actually what we know now is that a panic attack, which I didn't know that's what it was called, but a panic attack fires in your amygdala in 1/10 of a second. Right. And that is why we say they come out of the blue.
So you're like defenseless. You're literally.
You're defenseless. Yeah. Like there's no cognitive part of your brain that can say, I'm sitting in my language arts room. I'm safe. Nothing's wrong with me. There's no earthquake because my amygdala in 1/10 of a second tells me that I'm in extreme danger. And so I would be sitting there and the walls felt like they were closing in. My entire body started to shake. Mm. I knew my name was Kim Sablehaus, but I didn't understand why my name was Kim Sablehaus. I didn't understand why I was in the room. I had feelings of disorientation, unreality. Sometimes my heart would beat really fast, but I am not the type of person who feels like they're going to have a heart attack. Many people who have panic attacks, that's their number one symptom. My number one symptom is I'm losing consciousness. Everything around me looks disoriented. I'm confused in feelings of really unreality and disassociation.
Wow. And so what does that look like to the people looking at you?
Interestingly enough, most people don't see you having the panic attack.
Okay.
You are most fearful also of humiliating yourself and embarrassing yourself, but it's mostly going on the inside of you. And so you feel this great need to escape. That's the other thing. I have to get out of this room or whatever it might be. And so when I was in high school, I would eventually be in such anguish. I would tell the teacher that I didn't feel good. And then I would go to the office. And long story short, because I could talk about that part of my life forever, but I began to have these attacks numerous times a day. And they diagnosed me with low blood sugar. Then they thought I had complex seizure disorder. And so from the time I was 16 until about age 24, my life became debilitating. I struggled to do the simplest of things because I never knew when an attack was going to happen. And the best way, if it's okay for me to explain what a panic attack really feels like.
Yeah.
I tell the average person, because I think it's really hard for people who haven't experienced this to really understand what's happening. But if I were to put you, Laura, or Scott on a train track, and I was to tell you, you are not allowed to move. You have to stand on that track. And the train is coming at you at 300 miles per hour. And I promise you, you're not in any danger. You're completely safe. The train is not going to hit you,
right,
but it's going to stop 1 inch before it gets to you. Can you imagine how you would feel? Like that's the most intense fear or terror a person probably could feel. And so someone like me feels like that multiple times a day, and there's no train coming at me. There's no one holding a knife to my neck. There's no almost accident.
Right.
So at least your brain can attach a logical reason.
Exactly. Yes.
But because my brain can't, I think I'm crazy.
That was actually my next question is did you think you were crazy?
100%.
Wow.
Yes. All of a sudden, everything became difficult. Walking to my mailbox became difficult. Leaving my house and driving 5 minutes to work became difficult. Driving to Walmart and having to just drive there was terrible. But like go in the door, that's, you know, and I remember, you know, when I finally got a diagnosis and I finally got therapy, which was, you know, 10 years into this, when I'm like, okay, I'm 20 years old and 2-year-olds are functioning better than me.
Right.
2-year-olds can go to Walmart and they can happily go around the aisle away from their mommy. And I'm 20 years old and my husband has to go to Walmart and he has to be within eyesight at all times in case I have this attack and need help.
Wow. I want to just stop there because that was so much. Thank you for sharing all of that too. That was so helpful for me to really understand what this looks like for you.
We're going to take just a quick break to tell you about a cool new product that Scott and I discovered, and we'll get back to our guest's amazing Only One story in just a minute.
This episode is being brought to you by Voyage AC.
Here, take a whiff of this, honey.
Wow. That's not your signature scent, but I like it. I really like it.
Good. I was thinking of wearing it for our date weekend, along with some really sexy heels and stockings.
Whoa. There might be some kids listening, hon.
Wait till I tell you what it's called.
Parents, cover your kids' ears. What's it called?
Dirty Whore.
What? No
it's,
way.
It's a rush of rose and amber, and it's just a little in your face. For this weekend, hon, I think it's perfect.
When do we leave?
Voyage AC has everything you need. You can find all the amazing gifts, luxurious faux fur throws, candles, beachwear, diffusers, clutches, glamorous masks, hand sanitizer, and a perfume for every occasion. So how can our listeners find Voyage AC?
You can find everything on their website at www.voyageac.com. That's VoyageEtcie.com.
And as you know, Melanie is willing to give my friends and family discount to all our listeners right now.
She's the best.
Especially all the parents who want to get away for the weekend. That's 10% off everything you buy.
Yep. All you need to do is enter the only one at checkout.
That's right. All you have to do is enter the only one when you make your purchase. Voyage AC is an olfactory journey of candles, perfume, and organic beauty products.
As a podcast network, our first priority has always been audio and the stories we're able to share with you. But we also sell merch, and organizing that was made both possible and easy with Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell and grow at every stage of your business, from the launch your online shop stage all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. They have an all-in-one e-commerce platform and in-person POS system, so wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. Shopify has allowed us to share something tangible with the podcast community we've built here, selling our beanies, sweatshirts, and mugs to fans of our shows without taking up too much time from all the other work we do to bring you even more great content. And it's not just us. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Shopify is also the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/realm, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/REALM now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/realm.
Are you thinking about getting into Dungeons & Dragons? Maybe you're looking to expand your horizons as a DM or a player. If that's the case, then it's time for you to check out The Dungeon Cast, the best D&D podcast out there that helps you passively learn all about the game just by listening. Find The Dungeon Cast anywhere you get podcasts or on YouTube.
So you went from a child who kind of had these safety mechanisms where you needed to be able to have eyes on the people that were closest to you to know that you were safe.
Yes.
To a sophomore in high school that would get a... So the panic attack was really you getting attacked by panic. It wasn't like you having a panic attack. It was being attacked, right?
Yes.
And then these attacks would come at any moment without you being able to predict them. And you would endure them and then kind of push through, right? You would get through them and then be able to go on to the next thing.
Yes, and then immediately the fear of the fear would start again.
Right.
Am I going to have another one? Is it going to strike again?
Sure.
Or what if I leave my safe place, which is my home, where my husband is? Or, and so then immediately your body becomes so accustomed to scanning how it feels that it's constantly like, do I feel okay? Do the walls look all right?
Yeah.
Do I know who I am? And so then that becomes like this vicious cycle where now I'm overly sensitized to any bodily feelings and sensations, which means I have even more triggers now that are exacerbating the panic attacks.
And so you mentioned just a minute ago, and I know that you're married. Did they get in the way of courtship? Like, how did that happen? Was it a separate thing where the panic attacks didn't really affect your relationship?
Oh, that's such a good question. And it could be another episode, but I'm going to share what I know about that. So when I got married the first time, I feel like I chose someone who knew this about me and accepted it, and it was another safe person for me. But for years, Laura, I always say, like, who Kim is on the inside and who she had to be externally never matched up. And I had a lot of anger and resentment because I am this, and I can identify this in myself even as a little girl. I'm fiery and I'm fierce and I'm a go-getter and I'm a high achiever and I'm independent and I have big dreams for my life. And then I had this panic thing that changed how I had to do life.
Right.
Right. I went to college only an hour away because it felt safe. Then I quit because I needed to be back home with mommy and daddy where I felt safe. And I worked as a secretary. Then I married a man who knew this about me. And then 5 years later, when I am starting to get healthy again, I am becoming more of who I am on the inside. And it feels kind of sad to say this, but like, I always feel sorry for my first husband because the woman he married was not really who I am. And I feel sorry for me that I had to become someone who at the time I felt like I got really ripped off in life in all areas because I suffered from this illness.
Right, right. You felt like you were sentenced, right?
Yes. Yeah. I felt like it changed the trajectory of everything. I mean, I was on the path to, you know, I was going to go to Indiana University, get my degree. I was going to go live in a big city. I was going to, you know, and it's interesting, right? Here I am 30 years later and I still live in the hometown I was born and raised in. And my mom lives 3 minutes away and dad, but not so much maybe for that reason, but it's as if my life had to follow a different trajectory that wasn't aligned with how my soul wanted to show up.
Right. He became another safe space for you because what you were describing earlier, being scared to drive to work, struggling to walk to the mailbox, that's agoraphobia. Is that correct?
Yes, that's agoraphobia.
You were diagnosed with that?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. And then
so I didn't just have panic disorder. Some people just have panic disorder without agoraphobia. I developed full-blown agoraphobia.
Okay. Wow.
But I still did everything. I still went to work. It was just awful for me. And nobody knew, like, the fact that I got my car and drove 5 minutes to my secretarial job, that was like the hardest thing I had done that day. So
right.
Far.
Right.
And it's 8:05, you know,
it's amazing. And you know, when you and I talked, I equated your story so much to my story with addiction, because I led a life where no one knew how addicted I was to the substances that I was imbibing. And, you know, it would be a huge triumph to get dressed and go, you know, I did everything. I was parent association president. I played tennis. I worked out. I got my nails done. I got my hair done. And, you know, it was such an achievement to get to the nail salon and get through a manicure.
Yes.
But no one knew. And I couldn't share it with anybody, obviously, because that's not something that people would have definitely side-eyed me. Like, you need help if that's an accomplishment.
And I think that's why, like, it's so, like, I feel like it's so important to discuss these topics because
yes.
We go to great, like, anybody that I even went to school with in high school or who's known me, even during that time, they had no idea.
Yeah.
I wasn't about to share it because it's bad enough that I think I'm crazy. I don't need you to think I'm crazy too.
Right. Right. Yeah. That's the thing is the front, you know, until I was called out, it was okay. Like I would just do whatever I had to do to maintain this front.
And the hard part, just listening, is that it reminds me that I rob myself, like you rob yourself of,
yes.
of knowing who you are and what you really want because you're constantly playing the front. You
yeah,
know?
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
So I had a bottom in my addiction, which led me to get sober 12 plus years ago. I know that you had a bottom too. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. You know, my panic attacks would begin the moment my husband at the time would leave for work. So he would leave the house at like, you know, 7, and that would give me 20 or 30 minutes by myself before I had to leave. And so that 20 or 30 minutes was usually spent running back and forth to the phone, calling him because I, or getting ready to call him because I thought I was having an attack. And at this point, I mean, I felt like I was having them multiple attacks all day long. And I was really at an all-time low. I was frustrated. No one knew what was wrong with me. I didn't know what was wrong with me. Many times I felt like I needed to be checked and like, do I just need to go to a psychiatric hospital? I don't understand. But it was one of the times he had just left and it was about 5 minutes into it. And I was over at the phone, and sometimes it was just enough to have my hand on the phone, so it was ready to call should I need help. Because the thing with this illness is you don't have 2 seconds. You know, you feel like you're dying and losing your mind right there within that 1/10 of a second. So it's not like something like, well, okay, just sit down and breathe, you know, a couple minutes, you know, he would come. It's not, you feel like you're going to be out of it within a second. So I had my hand on the phone. I was debating about whether or not to call him. And that's embarrassing in itself, right? Like every time I have to call him, that's, I feel even worse about myself. But yeah. This was probably around the mid-1990s. And I don't know if you remember this or not, but at that time, the decor in the homes was like the forest green and burgundy.
Yeah, I do.
Do you remember that? Yeah. Every room had that color.
Yeah.
And for some reason, there was something inside of me that just surrendered. I walked to the bathroom, and I still to this day remember the forest green bath mat rug on my teeny tiny floor. I got down on that rug, and I just telling the story every single time it elicits the extreme suffering that I was in. But like I can still to this day, and I'm tapping my cheek as I say this, because I still feel that bath mat on my cheek. And I really just curled up in a fetal position, and I made a plea with God. And my plea was, I just need you to take this life from me. I cannot do this anymore. And I don't have it in me to slit my wrist or find a gun. Like, I just need you to go ahead and take me, because I can't keep living like this. And when I tell that story, it's so hard, because that darkness for a person to be in a place where they just need relief, a 15-minute space where I didn't have to constantly monitor if I was dying or losing my mind or needing to go to a psychiatric hospital. And I pleaded. And when I go back to this moment that was so defining for me, I try to remember if it was an actual voice I heard, if it was a deep intuition. I feel like I got a message, and that message very clearly pivoted me in that moment when I was curled up in the fetal position, begging God to take my life. And that message was, you are made for more, Kimberly. You get up off that bath mat and you get your life back. You get help. And here I am in the darkest moment of my life, which you know what that feels like, Laura.
I do.
You have been there. You understand the complete hopelessness that comes from that dark, dark place. And you know, I get goosebumps when I talk about it, because I really think that that was his invitation to me. He was inviting me to say, this is part of your story. And believe it or not, someday it's going to be your mission and your work in this life. Wow. And so I don't know exactly what transpired after that, but I know that shortly after that, I went to my general practitioner, Dr. Gene Ress, who has since passed away. And he's one of those doctors that practiced until he died, like until he was 88 years old. So he was even older when I went to him. And when I explained to him what was happening, he said, Kim, I've really been researching and studying this interest in anxiety disorders. And I'm going to tell you what you have is called panic disorder. And just when he said that, I was like, I'm not just crazy. I can't just, you know, like my mom who loves me very much, but the people around me are like, you know, you're safe, honey. There's nothing wrong. Right. You know, just sit and breathe. You're going to be fine. And I mentally, which now if you understand panic disorder, you understand why a person cannot just pull over on the side of the road and repeat, I am safe. I am safe. Like, and I'm going to go a little bit further into that because I think we need to later on in this episode, understand the difference between a panic attack and an anxiety attack, because there's a very clear difference between those two and how we handle them as well. But he said, Kim, it's all about the chemicals in your brain. They're called neurotransmitters. It's serotonin. And he explained the whole process. He said the serotonin is not jumping over the synapse, which is the gap. You're not getting enough in it. And it's causing these feelings. And then you becoming fearful of those feelings has kind of caused this loop to begin happening in your brain.
Wow.
And he said, I'm going to put you on an antidepressant called Zoloft. And I'm also going to suggest that you see Dr. Mary Posner, who's a psychologist, and get some counseling on this. And I'm going to tell you that in a period of 10 or so weeks, I went from what felt like 20 panic attacks a day to very few, and eventually to not having any.
Wow.
But I was also doing the work on the back end. I was going to my therapist and doing what's called cognitive behavioral therapy. So I was retraining my brain to understand what panic disorder was. And I had to do things like exposure therapy. So like I had homework every week. And one time, you know, she was like, okay, Kim, here's what you're going to do. You're going to drive to Walmart every day this week. And just that in itself, Lauren Scott, I would have been like, just cut my two arms off. Like, right. I don't even want to drive. Like, literally, if I have a choice between you chopping both arms off and me driving to Walmart, I know people who are listening, they're like, oh, Kim, you're being dramatic. I'm not. The mental anguish of having to do that was just like, and you're not only going to do that, but you're going to walk to the back of the store, you're going to touch the wall, and you're going to walk out. And you're going to do that over and over and over. And you're going to sit in a spinny chair when everybody leaves the prosecutor's office where you work. And you're going to spin in that chair and you're going to make yourself dizzy and feel the feelings of unreality. So you can teach yourself, you can feel those feelings and you're still safe.
Wow.
You know?
Yeah.
And so like I worked really hard on that piece along with medication. And I believe it saved my life.
Yeah. That's incredible, Kim. If you could just stop for a moment, because I want you to keep talking about this, but well, maybe this is part of your coaching. So I'll let you finish, because I wanted to ask you, what's the most compassionate thing I can do for a young person who may be experiencing these attacks, or an adult? Because I'm a very impatient person and I will often dismiss symptoms like the ones you're describing as someone just being dramatic or extra.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
Yes.
And I definitely do not want to do that, especially if someone may be suffering from being attacked by their own brain, right?
Exactly. And yeah. I think that's what we do, right? We even do this to little kids or to adults. Like the worst thing you can do is tell them to calm down.
Yeah. Okay.
You know, and even like we all know dramatic people, like there's a dramatic flair to children or to people. I would even say that I have that dramatic flair, but understanding that even if you see it as dramatic or not making sense, you always have to go back to the feeling and understand that the feeling, it's a feeling. It has to be acknowledged. It's how they feel, regardless if you can understand it or if it makes sense to you. And so, you know, I think that it understanding that, and it's interesting, I don't know if you've heard the term The Highly Sensitive Person by Dr. Elaine Aron. Have you heard that?
I've been called that,
but I live with one. Yeah.
Yes. Oh my gosh, Scott, I'm going to save you today. Are you ready?
Yeah.
Please.
So I literally just had a coach last week open this idea up to The Highly Sensitive Person. She's written several books, and there's a test online at hsperson.com, hsperson.com. Mm-hmm. And you take this assessment of like 27 questions, and I scored positive for 25 of the 27.
Wow.
And the thing that even last week hearing this, it makes so much sense in my marriage to my husband today, in the way that I parent my child. Like, a highly sensitive person feels everything to a very deep level, which makes me also a prime candidate for this disorder, although part of it's genetic as well. But, you know, understanding, because we all get told like how we're supposed to act, behave, speak, navigate the world. Like, this is the box, and this is what makes a good person. This is how most people act, and this is the right way to act and behave and operate. And what happens is we all try to conform to who we think we're supposed to be, rather than understanding, oh, actually, there's this other side of me, and it has a lot of gifts, but it also has some struggles too.
Right.
You know, well, because there's nobody to.
It's like you're always trying to fit who you are into the world as you think it might work, instead of being yourself. And, you know, it was when I met Laura and how we met that allowed me, she embraced who I was. And it was the first time in my life. I think for a highly sensitive person, and I think about this all the time, the worst thing you can say is you're too sensitive. And I'm like, I'm like, dude, how do I change that? Like, what do you expect me to do with that? And then I get that small feeling you say where I have to like take who I am and try to fit it into the world instead of just leading with who I am. Yeah.
And it's quadruple because you're a man. So then you really feel less.
Yes.
Trust me, I've hidden out for a long time with that.
Yeah. I mean, it's amazing the gender assignment that we give to this type of thing. Sensitivity falls squarely into female only, right?
Absolutely.
It's only allowed.
Absolutely. Yeah. And so like understanding, you know, for even for me to understand, like, also, I'm going to guess that Scott is probably the most empathetic, compassionate person, Laura, you've ever met.
He is, yes.
And so, like, why do we have to take these things that are true about us, like even a label, right? I'm a highly sensitive person. Why can't we see, and this is with everything, if you have attention deficit disorder, whatever it is, there are hidden jewels that come with you being different. Yes, you have struggles that someone else doesn't have, but there's this whole other bounty of goodness that comes from the way you navigate the world.
Wow.
And the more we can say like, I'm not going to go through life feeling ashamed because I am dramatic. I am over, you know, I am sensitive. Like, that is my gift. That's what I call it
my superpower.
I love that. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah,
he does.
I do remember the first time I heard the term emotionally intelligent, because that also allowed me to see those things I had seen for so long as a negative, as something positive.
Yeah.
Something that was less understood by the masses, I suppose.
Yes. And I've always felt like, I always tell people, like, I, you know, on Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, there's the Island of Misfit Toys.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah, we love the island. Yes.
Yeah. And I'm like, I'm on that island. And now that I can finally like say that, like, it's freeing.
Yes.
It is freeing.
Those were the best toys.
They are the best toys. They are.
So
we are so much fun to play with.
We are. Kim, I only have you for a few more minutes, and there's a couple more things I want to talk about.
Yes.
You became a coach.
Yes.
Yes. Tell me about your coaching.
Okay. So the third thing, I feel like I did four things to heal myself and to continue healing. And that was, I got on an antidepressant. I got therapy. I also did homeopathy, which was wonderful.
Yeah.
And I dove in like to the self-help field. Like, it lit me on fire because I was convinced that I had to take 100% responsibility for my life, and that it was up to me to create my life going forward from the inside out.
Right.
And so I always tell people I became a happiness coach because for 20 years, I have like investigated and just really thrown myself into understanding how do we wake up every day, every damn day excited to live our life? Because here's the thing, Laura, that's different about me and maybe you. When's the last time you walked out of Target or Walmart or the grocery store and you looked up in the skies and you said, thank you, that was easy?
Yeah, I've never done that.
Right. You're like, oh, the Target again, you know?
Yeah.
And so because of my adversity, I do have a different lens through which I view life.
Right.
But I also know that we can teach others how to immerse themselves and create a life that feels really good to who they are. And so I actually became a school teacher. I was a fourth grade school teacher, and then I was a curriculum director. And then I launched my own business, Strobel Education, which was really all about going into schools and giving keynotes and professional development for teachers. All of that started to happen. And then, which I just have to say, isn't it crazy that we take the woman who couldn't walk to her mailbox and we're like, yes, guess what? You might have shook so badly in your high school speech class that you couldn't even read your index cards. And no one would have thought you would have become a motivational speaker. But now you stand on a stage with thousands of people in the crowd. So
amazing.
Yes. And then I became a happiness coach. I decided that I didn't just want to work in schools. Like, I want to work with women specifically, and I want to show them how to show up in their lives in bigger, bolder, and braver ways. And that means that we have to do hard things. That means that we have to work on ourselves. And, you know, I just have to say this, Laura, because I'm not healed. Here's what you also need to know. I suffered the biggest relapse of my life in 20 years. In the fall of 2018.
Okay. What did that look like?
Yeah. I was driving back from giving a talk. I was going along the highway. It came on out of nowhere. I hadn't had one in a really long time. It lasted for 45 minutes. I pulled over on the side of the road. I mean, it was awful. I had diarrhea. I went in the woods. I threw up. I did all of those things. I barely made it home. And that sent me all the way back to where I was when I was 20 years old.
Wow.
Like, the whole pattern started again, and I could not believe it. And I was in the middle of launching my happiness coaching program for women. And I was like, this is crazy. Like, I am the most unhappy in my life, and I'm creating this course for women.
Yeah.
And I was pissed at God again. I was like, look, dude, I took your lesson and I use it for good.
Right.
What I do good work with my suffering. Why are you having me endure this again? And so I had to go back to everything. I had to go back to applying all my principles. Thank goodness I had a set of tools that I didn't have back when I was 20 years old. So I recovered quicker. This didn't last 10 years. It lasted, you know, a year or so. And my learning in that, Laura, is I always think, how do we take this awful thing? And we can't always do it when we're in the middle of it, but there has to be some new layer to who you are when you come out of that.
Wow. I was just going to say, it reminds me of that measurement of physical fitness is not, you know, how tired you get or how it's how quickly you recover in between, right? So if I run however many, you run a lot of miles, but if I even ran a mile, you know, and then I ran a mile the next day, it wouldn't be like how tired I was at the end of each mile, but how quickly I recovered in between. So you had this really debilitating, you know, what we would call in, you know, alcoholism recovery, a relapse.
Yes.
And then you recovered faster because you had tools, which is so cool to me.
I did. Yeah. It was really hard, and it was really exasperating to think that I was back there again.
Yeah.
But my new learning was that I have always, even though I've taken this panic disorder and I use this message to help others, there was still a part of me that just thought of it as weak. It's just weak, weak, weak energy. And there's Kim again. There's weak little Kim who is scared to leave her house. And I hate her and I despise her. And how dare her come to the forefront, because I've done everything to dismiss her. Mm. I've started my own business. I've launched my career. I travel across the country. I'm a high achiever in all areas of my life. And damn you, you think you're going to show up again in my life? And what I realized is I can't push that part of myself away. Right. I can't. It's me. When I step on the stage and I'm bold and I'm fierce and I'm mesmerizing the crowd, I'm also bringing with me the Kim who sometimes still has struggles.
Wow.
And so now I honor my fierceness, but I love and accept my vulnerabilities because they are part of who I am on a daily basis. They deserve to be and take up space mm-hmm. in my life. That's my new learning.
Ooh, girl, mm-hmm. that is incredible. And I saw it. I saw you at the microphone on a stage with the little Kim, you know, yes. with you there, right next to you or as part of you, addressing that crowd. I could see the whole thing. Thank you for that.
My goodness.
We are basically out of time, which makes me so sad, but I knew this conversation was going to be this like amazing.
You did, didn't
I
you,
did.
Honey? Yeah.
I was like, you're going to love this, hon. You're going to love this woman. And he does. And he's going to get to talk to you next. So I'm a little jealous of that. But tell me, Kim, what's next for you?
Oh, my goodness. Well, since we're in COVID, the live speaking events have just really taken a back seat right now. So
right.
I'm doing virtual ones and I'm launching my 90-day coaching program coming up in January. So I'm really excited about that. I really have this like course that I take women through that helps them do the work on themselves, you know, and really figure out who they are, like I said, on the inside so that they can step into who I know they are meant to be. And so we're kind of pumping our energy into that right now. And I have a free Facebook group where I kind of show up and do a lot of teachings as well. And you can drop that link in the show notes, but it's called She Finds Joy. It's the name of my podcast.
Yes.
And so I'm just really, I'm surrendering a little bit right now, Laura. I went to Vermont and I wrote the first 10 chapters of my book in solitude for 2.5 weeks. And so I'm in this kind of surrendering space right now, and I'm going to let the universe kind of reveal what it has in store for me going forward.
That's beautiful. Can you just tell me all the ways people can find you? We will have all the links in the show notes, but can you just say them out loud?
Yes. So if you go to Facebook, I have a free Facebook group called She Finds Joy, and it's just a really inspirational place where I show up and do little mini trainings. And it's a group of like-minded people who are willing to be real, you know?
Yeah.
And then my podcast is She Finds Joy. And on Instagram, I'm Kim Strobel Joy.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, Kim, it has been a trip. You took us on a journey, my friend. And I'm so grateful for it. Thank you for being, this was very much like our conversation. And so like I said, I was really excited to have it. I'm really excited to share it with the listeners. And I so appreciate you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Kim. Wonderful interview.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to The Only One in the Room. Please join us each Tuesday and Sunday for an incredible brand new Only One interview. And every Friday for On My Nightstand, where I'll be reading something that I love. If you have an Only One story you'd like to share, or a piece of writing you'd like to submit, please send it to theonlyonepod@gmail.com. From all of us at The Only One in the Room, we wish you dopeness, health, and prosperity.
Are you thinking about getting into Dungeons & Dragons? Maybe you're looking to expand your horizons as a DM or a player. If that's the case, then it's time for you to check out The Dungeon Cast, the best D&D podcast out there that helps you passively learn all about the game just by listening. Join co-hosts Will and Brian as they break down the lore of a rich multiverse 50 years in the making in a lighthearted and beginner-friendly way. They cover everything from character creation options to tips for dungeon masters. There's something for everyone, no matter how long you've been playing TTRPGs. Get inspired while learning all about the unique planes of existence. Get the in-depth knowledge you need to help your combat encounters feel impactful, or learn about the origins and pantheons of every race and class the game offers. No stone is left unturned as every edition of the game is explored and explained in a way that benefits players of all different levels of experience. You can expand your TTRPG horizons in a way that's as entertaining as it is educational just by listening. All you have to do is go to your favorite podcast app or YouTube and search for The Dungeon Cast.